Eldon Taylor with us. We're going to take your calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We'll take your phone calls. While I was thinking of Eldon Taylor and Elton John. Eldon, I may have called you Eldon John, as I was saying, we'll be right back.
You did. You did. And I was going to say, hey, have you ever interviewed Elton John? I mean, I love his music. What's he like to talk to?
I would love to interview him, but I might need a little self-hypnosis if I do that again, huh?
I doubt that, Mr. Dury.
Well, let me tell you something. You have helped so many people with these uplifting stories and works that you've done over the years. How did you get involved in all of this, Eldon?
I had my own epiphany is what it amounts to. I have no animus. I hold no grudges or blame. I'm gonna share a story that, I have long since let go, but I left home at a very early age, a dispute with my parents that was not nice and just a nasty affair. And for a very, very long time, I had a chip on my shoulder. And I had a real problem with authority. And the long and the short of it was I was angry. A lot of people around me thought, I was successful because I rose to the top of the field, what I was doing, and, I had those accoutrements. I had the money, I had the car, but I couldn't make anything in my life work. I went through relationships like people change shirts. It was really a sucky life. I was bitter, and I was paranoid, and then serendipity visited me, George. Mm-hmm. I ran this, I developed this technology, as we discussed earlier, for my lie detection practice. We patented it eventually. We call it InterTalk. I share how you can do this in this book. You can make your own, but it worked very well. And because it worked well, a friend of mine at the Utah State Prison said, Eldon, can we bring this out to the prison system and could we use this technology to rehabilitate inmates? I mean, could we, for all intent and purposes, maybe lower aggression, hostility, increase reflectivity, decrease impulsivity, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I don't know, but we can try. I set up a design. I got some people involved. A friend of mine was one of the best psychometrics guys in Utah. And so we did some very extensive psychometric testing. The whole design was to be pre and post. It was a good double-blind study. But when we ran the pre-psychometrics, we didn't discover anything we didn't know. We had high scores in self and social alienation. However, when I sat with these inmates, when we talked to these inmates, what I found was that they had the ability to displace responsibility. It wasn't their fault. But for the grace of God, there go you. My daddy was an alcoholic. My mommy was a prostitute. The neighbor boy mainlined me when I was 8 years old. I mean, those are the kinds of stories that we heard. Most often exaggerated. But even when they were true, George, you could have two brothers from the same home. One would be a physician in a teaching hospital and the other one in maximum security in the prison system. In other words, they made their own choices. They came from the same environment. They had similar stimuli. They simply made different choices. Now, as I watched this unfold, because we were getting ready to what is it we put on the program? Remember, we discussed there's two things. You have the technology, but then what is it you say, that's going to change this? So as we worked on this, I discovered that, the only way to undo their blame was what today we call the forgiveness set. I forgive myself. I forgive all others. I am forgiven. See, if you forgive, you can't blame. And if you can't blame, well, then you have to take responsibility. If you take responsibility, you can change things. You have the ability to rehabilitate yourself. You have the ability to alter the scenario. But to the extent you blame it, you tie yourself up. There's nothing you can do about it because it's not your fault. You didn't have anything to do. You were just a poor victim, and that bad stuff runs downhill, and it just happened to hit you on the head. That kind of of scenarios. So what happened to me, George, is as I worked on this program, what I saw was I had the same feelings these inmates had. What wasn't working in my life was due to how much I was blaming my mother, my father, the circumstances in my life for everything that took place. You know, I left home early. Because I left home early, you know, I was emancipated. My father was in law enforcement. He basically, there you go, you're on your own. I worked a couple of jobs while I went to high school. I was a perfect 4.0 student. Here I am coming up for graduation, just a couple of months before graduation. I'm called into the principal's office, and I'm told that because I haven't attended enough school, I've missed days for work and other things, they're not going to graduate me. I have to go to summer school. Now, I am the only 4.0 student in the school. I am valedictorian. I have a postgraduate scholarship waiting for me, and I've got to go to summer school. I am so furious about this. I threw down my books and the principals. I stomped out of the high school. I never went back. I was 25 before I ever went back to college. So, I had all this anger and all this animus about all of this that had been brought about because, you know, I'd left home. What I had done was find a socially acceptable way to act out my hostility, act out my aggression. That's all.
It
works.
What
Freud would call was sublimation.
Yeah.
When I discovered this, when I saw myself in these inmates, and this double-blind study, by the way, was very effective. The data was overwhelming. I began to employ it on myself, and it was a complete change in my life, a total turnaround. Ended up, of course, changing my career as well.
Well, let's take some calls. Let's start by going to Raleigh, North Carolina. Marvin's with us. Hey, Marv, thanks.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, Marv.
I wanted to call and give my 200% approval stamp on Eldon's work. When I went back to college in the mid-70s, I was very fortunate that the counseling program there had a counselor, or a couple of them, but at least one counselor, who taught self-hypnosis. When I would take tests, I would freeze up. I would lock up. It's like my brain was ice. And so I took the self-hypnosis. He taught it in about four or five different classes. He would teach us a step of it, and we would practice it for a week and come back and then add another step. And so we eventually learned self-hypnosis, and we could put ourselves under. And what we would do, we would meet each week, and we had an alcove where we could turn the lights down and so forth. And the counselor, we would turn in a 5 or 7 card to him with suggestions of what we needed to improve in and so forth. And so we would all turn those in. Well, when we would go under, he would read those to us in the form of a suggestion and make a suggestion. And even if we didn't write one that somebody else wrote, but we needed it, we would internalize it. And that would help us, you know, with that behavior or accomplish whatever that was. But everything that Eldon has said tonight is like 100% on target. Everything he said, I haven't had to experience it all. But I've learned about it. My degree was in psychology, so I learned a little bit about it and also used it. But if I had not done that, I would not have made good grades, you know, in college. And after I learned the self-hypnosis, I went from like C's and B's to mostly A's. And I graduated, I think it was a 3.9, 3.8 or 3.9 GPA. But that self-hypnosis alone is what freed me up to turn loose of the knowledge I had learned, studied, and heard in class.
How about that for a testimony, Eldon?
It's marvelous, Marvin, and that is fantastic. I mean, we actually ran a test anxiety study. I didn't run it. I created the programs. The study was run at Stanford University. What they did is they compared in a very unique design aerobic exercise with our subliminal test anxiety program. And, the interesting thing was aerobic exercise has been proven to be effective at reducing test anxiety. There was a control group, people that didn't get anything. But we did better with the subliminal program than the aerobic exercise. You are absolutely right, Marvin. You know, when you think about these blocks, these mental blocks, like, you know, maybe mine was, you know, performance anxiety, because I'll swear to you that 30 years ago, 35 years ago, there's no way I would have been on this telephone, on this radio show for 3 hours. I would have panicked prior to that, like your experience with you know, taking an examination. And it's all a mental block. And when we are able to go beyond that mental block, when we're able to tap into our own potential, what'd you say? You graduated 3839, magna summa lauda? Hey, congratulations.
That.
Way to go, Marvin.
Can it work all the time? Or what are people, if they hit their heads against the wall, Eldon, and they just can't seem to do it? Is that possible?
Well, yes, but it's less likely when you get into the unconscious. The reason most of us hit ourselves on the proverbial wall, the reason we make all these New Year's resolutions only not to keep them, is that we have this inner contestant, if you will. This, you know, I think of it this way. We have two systems to the mind. System one is automatic. You know, I'm driving down the highway, the freeway, I'm off in thought, suddenly there's my exit, and I become aware, oh, there's my exit, I need to change lanes and exit. For 20 minutes or so, maybe I have been off into the spaces in whatever I've been thinking about, but I have been driving very safely on full automatic. Okay? Everybody has experienced that. System one is the subconscious taking over and doing lots of things for us that are to our benefit. But system one also takes over and does other things. Recently, let me give you an example of this. I said earlier the nucleus accumbens makes these decisions. Recently, I was at a CEU course. It was facilitated by a Dr. King on addictions. King, overweight fellow, you know, told the story of how he wanted to lose some weight. So what he did is he had just moved to a new city, and that city didn't have a Krispy Kreme donut in it. The nearest Krispy Kreme donut was 5 miles down the road. He had to get on the freeway to get to that Krispy Kreme. And so what he decided he'd do is, since he loved Krispy Kreme donuts and he ate so many, if he just stopped eating Krispy Kreme donuts, he'd lose weight. So a month or two passes, he's doing well, he's losing weight, and then he has to go out of town.
A binge. So I see a binge coming.
Yeah, so he gets up on the freeway, and as soon as he gets up on the freeway, he realizes Krispy Kreme. And part of him says, well, you know, Krispy Kreme donuts, we could stop and just have one. We haven't had one in a couple of months. And another part says, no, no, you know, we never have one. And then he talks back. Yeah, but you know, we were going to get a cup of coffee. Maybe we'll just get our cup of coffee there. And the other part says, no, you know what they smell like. If you go into that donut place, you're going to get more. And this conversation continues until he realizes he has exited the freeway and is parking his car in the Krispy Kreme donut parking lot. All right, you know, well,
how does this happen?
Most of us have had an experience somewhat similar to that. Anyone that has ever said, well, I'm going to lose weight, I'm not going to have that snack, or I'm through, I'm going to stop smoking. You know, I smoked. Everybody, when I, you know, grew up, smoked. I remember Edward R. Murrow smoking on television, you know, during the 6 o'clock news. So I was a heavy smoker. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day for many, many years. When it came time for me to quit smoking, you know, the first thing I did, and I admit to this honestly, is I took one of my own smoking programs, subliminal, and I put it in my car. Now, you know, whenever I get into my car, that program would come on automatically. I had a Blaupunkt sound system in that car. So you know, maybe a week has gone by, and the cigarettes I'm getting taste nasty. I mean, George, they are the stalest, rottenest cigarettes that... So one morning I get up, and I'm not going to have any more of these stale damn cigarettes. I'm going to go down to 7-Eleven, get myself a cup of coffee first thing, and a fresh pack of cigarettes. So I forced the, well, not forced, but I had a nice clerk that was willing to hand me several packs so I could feed them and make sure I had a nice fresh one. I bought myself a fresh pack of cigarettes, got my cup of coffee, went back out, sat down in my car, and lit up that cigarette. And it was nasty, horrible.
Good.
What is going on? I started my car, and on came this subliminal music. I stopped. That's what it is. It's that damn tape. I pulled the tape out of the car, threw it outside the window, and drove away. I wasn't ready to stop smoking. I realized that what was going on was those affirmations were telling me the cigarettes weren't any good. They didn't taste good, and so on and so forth. And I was processing that information, and it was making me fully aware of the fact that they don't taste good. They never did taste good. Now, it was a few years later that I finally decided, okay, well, it's time to stop. And I'm going to do this properly. And then again, I employed both self-hypnosis and subliminal program, and I stopped. And I got up one Easter morning and didn't have a cigarette at all. About 6 o'clock that evening, my wife said to me, "You're not smoking." And I said to her, "No, I decided to quit." And that's how I did it, on 3 packs of cigarettes a day. But at the time, and the first approach was just using the subliminal. As I listened to the subliminal, I was processing the information, but I didn't have that totality that comes when you combine both modalities, and you say to yourself consciously, "Okay, it's time." Instead, what I had done is say to myself, "Well, you know, I don't know about stopping, but I'll play one of these programs, and maybe I'll change my mind."
Good point. Eldon, we're going to take a break in just a moment. We're going to come back and take these final phone calls. Where do you get your book, Self-Hypnosis?
Right now, listen, if you go to my website, eldontaylor.com, there's a special offer there. You're going to end up buying your book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. You're not going to buy it from me. But because of the promotion that we have, all the authors and other people that are joined together to help promote this book, there are a number of gifts, hundreds of gifts that you can pick up at my website when you do get the book, and a number of drawings, special drawings. There's some great people that are supporting it, and they range from, you know, the physicians to the Hollywood Linda Evans, indeed. You remember Linda Evans, huh?
I sure do. Eldon, hold on. We're coming right back. Final calls on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to be talking about our own origins, but through the eyes of the temples of the gods. Michael Tullinger joins us on Coast to Coast AM. When we come back with Eldon Taylor, we'll take final calls as we talk about self-hypnosis and subliminal technology. And welcome back to Coast, Eldon Taylor with us. Let's go to the phones. Debbie in Jensen Beach, Florida. Hey, Debbie, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I'm a longtime listener. God bless Art Bell.
Thank you.
Yeah, really. Listen, I just wanted to know if you could please take a moment to discuss the effects of being cursed. And, sometimes it just feels as if a nation, we're operating under the burden of the old Jedi mind trick. And I wonder if you could delve into the possibility that as a nation, are we under the weight of a curse? And could we make a united front and come out from underneath such a thing?
What do you think of that, Eldon?
Well, first, I don't think that I'm adequately prepared to answer that. I don't believe in curses per se. On the other hand, I do think that most of us live in a environment where we see less and less civility in our world. And, you know, the divisiveness that is promoted often in political campaigns, the rhetoric, the passion that people bring, that tends to exaggerate this absence of civility. I think there are other things going on that also pressurize the population today. You know, I posted on my own Facebook page today a new study that, well, actually it wasn't a study, but it was a very well-done article that had some historical studies in it that looked at this December 21st date. And in many people's minds, they see something is going to happen of great significance on 1221, the Mayan calendar, Nostradamus. And I know you've done shows on this. In fact, I'll give you a plug. I don't know what I would do if I wasn't a member and didn't have access to your shows, because I don't stay up till 2 a.m. except when I'm on it. But I get them every day, and they are a great contribution. So I know you've covered these kinds of things, but, you know, there isn't going to be a significant eschatological event any more than there was on 5/5/2000 or there was on January 1, 1900 or January 1, 1800. And when you look at the data, you know, all of these days had associated with them some end days, and they had a Nostradamus or someone else attached to them. So there is that kind of thing. And then there is, you know, what's going on in the Arab nations and the unrest there. And because we have a 24/7 media cycle, we're constantly reminded of the dangers in the world. So where I'm going to is there is a heightened sense of arousal in our population, and it is due in large to the fear-mongering. And whether that's a politician telling you that if you don't elect me, this guy's going to do all this bad stuff to you and cause all these bad things to this country, or it's, you know, discussions that seem to take more rational means, like conversations about what do we do if we have a nuclear Iran, or it's the 1221 or the super volcano in Yellowstone. We are bombarded continually with information that heightens our sense of arousal. Now, I'm going to exaggerate that even a little more. Not that I'm exaggerating, but that sense of arousal is exaggerating. In order for media to reach us today, it must entertain us. Whatever it is that we are giving our time to cannot be boring. In order for it not to be boring, it must meet a threshold of arousal. If we look historically, we see very quickly that violence and sex is a case in point, two fundamentals that reach to our basic psychological drives, have increased systematically over time. The skirt blowing up on Marilyn Monroe because of air from a street vent is hardly titillating today. Primetime television, we see things that in the 50s would have just been shocking. The violence in television, in movies is, I mean, I one of them, the statistics I have burned into my head because it's Sylvester Stallone, and in First Blood, one bad guy gets killed in the entire movie. That's 1982. But by the time he gets out to Rambo in 2008, we kill 83. You know, the kind of violence escalates, as does the sexuality like that. So what are we left with? All right, this is what we're left with. We have this heightened sense of arousal, and it's unidentified. We're not really sure what causes it because we are maintained in that state. It's, you know, your question earlier about what would happen if you had an honest candidate that ran an honest campaign didn't attack the other. You know, I would love nothing more than to see that work, but, you know, it would turn out to be boring and people would turn it off.
You really think so? I think this might be a time period, Eldon, where that might be different.
Well, I hope you're right. I mean, I would love to see that, because what happens with all this heightened sense of arousal and this need for immediate gratification, you know, wow, wasn't that something? Boy, you know, what happens with that? According to Philip Zimbardo, past president of the APA, writing in his book, The Lucifer Effect, which really discusses all those things the human being is capable of, the dark side of the human being, that study after study has shown comes out pretty easily. He wrote this: we have found that pathological symptoms may develop in up to one-third of normal participants in the rational process of their trying to make sense of unexplained sources of arousal. All right, you want a curse? The curse has been self-administered by our willingness to swallow down all this information, to participate in the fear-mongering by insisting that we have more arousal. But instead of turning off this media, instead of walking away, you know, the American public says they hate negative ads, and yet time and time again, the negative ads are the ones that work. So instead of being responsible and turning these things off, taking 20 minutes to meditate, instead of doing a responsible thing, what we do is we perpetuate this by participating in it. You know, John Locke said there was such a thing as tacit consent. Tacit consent is when we don't object. We have thereby accepted and agreed. George, you make a very good point. You know, if enough people were to say, no, I'm objecting. I'm simply not watching this negative stuff. Go away. If we elected a politician anywhere, Timbuktu, because he ran the campaign you're talking about and people turned off the other, we as a society could begin to revoke the curse. But because we participate in it, we further propagate it, and that propagates the incivility that we see. The debates. We started this show with a conversation on the debates. I remember, I'm old enough to remember the first debate. I can't imagine John F. Kennedy or Richard Nixon yelling at each other, cutting each other off, getting into each other's face, sticking fingers and wagging it. When you have that high a level with that much, what? I mean, you can watch this and it would appear to be animus. That much hostility, that lack of civility at that level, what do we expect out of our children? What is it we're giving them to copy? What messages are we sending to them? If there is a curse, Debbie, I believe that's the source of the curse. And I believe the cure to the curse has to be in each of us taking the responsibility to do those things, as George suggested, that would remove us from participating in the curse.
Sacramento we go. It's Jackie's turn, first-time caller. Jackie, go ahead.
Hi. Yes, thank you, George. I had a question for your guest, Mr. Taylor. Mm-hmm. I had an experience about 14 years ago while under hypnosis, and I've wondered about it ever since. Just a brief background. At that time, I was under extreme stress. I was very depressed. I had actually thought about dying. So very bad situation. I don't know how I found the gumption, but I ended up at this clinic in a small Midwestern town where I was living at the time, a hypnosis clinic, the kind, you know, where they talk about they can help you with to stop smoking, weight loss, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I went to the clinic, told them I was there for, you know, I was thinking about maybe some weight loss. I thought maybe that would cheer up the situation. I went in and I told the person, I said, you know, they wanted to sign me up for the the full package. It was about $1,000 a month, whatever. And at the time, you know, I said, you know, I just can't afford to do that. I question whether or not that you can actually put me under hypnosis, and was questioning. And he said, well, okay, we'll give you one session. We'll see how it works. So anyway, they put me in this room, a dark room, very comfortable room, in a recliner with the headphones, the whole thing. Very easy to relax. So anyway, they started the tape, whatever. And the clinician, whoever he was, at one point I was aware where he had walked into the room, and he lifted my arm up. My arm stayed up, you know, where he put it over my head, and then he pushed it back down. I felt at the time I had no control over it. I mean, he actually had to lift it to move it. So anyway, the session was very good. I mean, the tape was really, really good. Kind of the end part of it, walking me down the stairs, I could hear chimes in the background. Anyway, long story short, I get to the bottom of the stairs, and there's no further talking. I'm just kind of hovering here. That's what it felt like to me, at the bottom of the stairs, kind of floating. And all of a sudden, I see three bright lights moving towards me. And the one in the middle was bigger, but I was aware that there were two smaller ones on either side. Anyway, as it got closer to me, I started feeling what they now talk about, you know, with near-death experiences, where people talk about how they feel that overwhelming love, et cetera, et cetera. Well, at that time, I didn't know anything about that. But under this situation, the light coming closer to me, that's what it felt like. I mean, I didn't feel like I was out of my body or anything like that, but I felt this overwhelming love, acceptance, and in my mind, I thought it was God. That is what I truly thought at the time. I'm not an overly religious person, fanatic, whatever, but that's what it felt like to me. And the bright was very, very light, bright like what they describe in the near-death experiences, where I could look at it. It didn't hurt me to look at it.
Let's get it. Let's get his reaction to some of this, Jackie, because we only got a few more minutes left, and I wanted to get a few more calls in. She obviously had quite an experience.
Yeah, and Jackie, what you experience is not uncommon, and that's why so many people will employ self-hypnosis in their process of learning meditation. That is, you know, that is an intent of meditation. What you're talking about is expressing the so-called end result of contact meditation. Now, you often hear of hypnosis being associated with metaphysical events of this nature. And the reason for that is, when we get out of our own way, we get into that still small voice within. We find that quintessential self. And we do receive this sense of unconditional love, unconditional peace. It is a very positive experience. They use hypnosis today for past life regressions, for remote viewing. I know, George, you've had Major Dame on your show.
And many remote viewers. Sure.
Yeah. And you know, I've had him on mine. And, of course, you know, when you start looking at how Ingo Swann originally acquired these abilities, it was because he put himself in this altered state. And it's in this altered state that allegedly we even have the ability to connect with a greater sense. So what most remote viewers call a holographic universe, where, you know, the thoughts of everybody kind of exist. You might think of it as the Jung did, the collective unconscious. But in order to have these experiences, we have to get out of our own way. Now, you know, there's always the question with regard to the veracity of the experience. What, did you really, Jackie, see God or not? You know, I think that's an academic question. The fact of the matter is, it gives you peace. It gives you comfort.
And that's all that matters.
And that's what you're after. You know, no one has definitive evidence. You can look at all of the evidence for life after death. George has written a wonderful book on that. And as far as I'm concerned, it is too compelling to ignore. But you can also find the Richard Dawkins of the world, author of The God Delusion, the great atheist king, who will attack that and look for, you know, I want to see the atom. I want to see what happens when you split the atom approach, the mechanistic secular approach. So, okay, in that contrast we live. As a pragmatist, if I have these experiences, if, as Ed Dame says, he's able to successfully explore through remote viewing some counterintelligence means, and he was decorated 3 times for that, well, great. He can also be wrong, we know. If you have this experience, and in this ineffable experience you know unconditional love, that cannot be taken away from you. That will forever give you peace and a sense of knowing that we call noetic. It's that inner knowing that there is more than what some of these mechanical folks focused on their machination processes might give rise to accepting as being possible. Does that make sense to you, Jackie? I hope so.
I hope so. Eldon, we're almost out of time, my friend. Once again, I want to thank you for a simply enlightening interview. You're always on, my friend, always.
Hey, you know, I love you, and you know that, and I love your show, and this is like a conversation with a good friend, and it's just natural, and I can't give you enough thanks for the opportunity to share and to join you again, George.
We help so many people. Thanks again. Eldon Taylor, the name of the book, Self-Hypnosis and Subliminal Technology. It's available all over the place, but included in this is a free CD with the hypnosis sessions. You're going to enjoy that. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottasour, Stephanie Smith, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.